Okay, well, numbers are stabilizing now, so we think we'll just get started with today's webinar. So once again, welcome to everyone who's joined us to February's BIPs webinar, where we'll be joined by Margaret Squires. She'll be talking to us about material networks, the Chehel-Sutun carpet between Iran and the Deccan. So welcome everybody, and thank you so much for joining us. I'll tell you a little bit about Margaret before I welcome her in. Margaret is currently a postdoctoral teaching fellow at the Courtauld Institute of Art in London, where she completed her PhD in art history. Her PhD research centered on carpets and their architectural contexts in Safavid Iran. Prior to her PhD, Margaret completed her MA in the history of art and architecture at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, as well as a BA in Middle East languages and literatures at the University of Virginia. Margaret's held both curatorial, teaching, and consulting roles at institutions including the Courtauld, where she is now, as well as the Museum of Fine Arts, Houston, the Kalousht Gulbenkian Museum, the V&A, and SOAS. And her research interests are obviously into this early modern Persianate world, but she's going to talk to us about carpets, and that's really where her particular expertise and interest lies. So we're all really excited to hear what she's going to talk to us today about the Chehel-Sutun carpet. And just before she starts, I'll remind you that next month, on the 18th of March, just before Nowruz, we'll be hearing from John Hyland, talking to us about Persia's Greek campaigns, kingship, war, and spectacle. So please do join us for that next month. If you want to follow us or see any of our previous webinars that have been recorded, you can go to our YouTube channel where you can see videos, and also you can see all of our social tags there to get in touch and keep up to date with all of our news and everything that we're doing, everything that's going on at BIPs. And just to remind you, there'll be opportunity for Q&A after Margaret's given us her presentation. So this is just a reminder of our commitments, our policies on being kind to each other, really. So just let's be respectful and to remember that we're a non-political organisation. Thank you very much. And now we'll be excited to welcome Margaret. And I'll hand over to you and I'll hide myself, Margaret. Thank you very, very much.
Hi everyone. First, I'd like to thank everyone in the audience for attending today's lecture. I'd also like to thank the British Institute of Persian Studies, not only for inviting me to speak in this webinar series, but also for supporting my research with a travel grant, which I used to present this paper at an international conference. Initially part of my dissertation research at the Courtauld Institute of Art, this project will now make up part of a monograph about the architectural context of carpets in the Safavid period. I'm pleased to share it with you today, and I welcome your feedback and commentary. I'll go ahead and share my screen now. This talk will relate the diverse experiences of those who encountered a work of art over 3 centuries, from Safavid princes to English diplomats to museum curators. I hope you'll forgive me for opening with my own. The first time I saw a fragment of the Chehel-Sutun carpet was in the Museum of Applied Art in Frankfurt, Germany, a few years ago. In my vision of how this viewing session would go, I pictured a smallish piece of carpet. After all, this is only one of 13 pieces of the carpet dispersed across museum and private collections, laid out across a work surface in the storeroom, a minor imposition for the curator and the conservator at the museum. And this was the only image that I had seen of this fragment before going to see it in person. As it turns out, seeing this carpet fragment required the cordoning off of an entire gallery and pushing together 6 tables. Even with the dimensions duly recorded in my notes before the viewing session, the mental images of every other 17th century carpet I have seen in person stubbornly blocked my comprehension of this fragment's superhuman scale until I finally stood before it. More recently, I was again astonished to see the size of another fragment from the same carpet. And I'm going to do the same thing to you. When you look at this image, the image that I had initially seen, try to imagine the scale. This time, I saw the fragment in the Cincinnati Art Museum. Just a small piece of the corner turned out to be gargantuan in scale. And I can almost fit both feet just in this slim inner border. My experience standing before these fragments follows in a line of awestruck observers before me. This carpet, in a complete state, must have been overwhelming to behold. When shrunken down in a photograph or reconstructed image, the proportions of its lattice design, floral motifs, and borders appear as those of an average-sized carpet. Standing at its center in the 17th century must have made one feel like a miniaturized person. Though no written account survives to attest to this experience in the years immediately following its manufacture, myriad commentators begin to chime in as the carpet transforms from Safavid palace furnishing to object of fascination and collectability for a growing group of carpet enthusiasts across Europe and North America in the 19th and 20th centuries. Its genre-defying scale is a consistent theme throughout, as it took on the title of the largest carpet ever made and gained an apocryphal origin story of traveling across Iran on the backs of two elephants. Piecing together these fragments and the documentary evidence surrounding them to form a cohesive history of the carpet will require some fastidious stitching and patching, and in the end, leave a few sections incomplete. The reward of this labor, however, will come as a picture begins to form of the carpet unfurled in its original palatial setting. This picture will have critical implications for the longer history of carpets in Iran, and particularly the changing ways of thinking about making and using them in the late Safavid period, as well as yielding insights into a two-way exchange of carpets, craftspeople, and ideas between Safavid Iran and the Deccan. In this paper, I will examine three forms of evidence to shine a light on three eras of this carpet's lifespan. The first will be the accounts of European and Iranian observers in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, the period in which the carpet was dismantled and dispersed. Elucidating this moment is essential for demonstrating that the carpet was indeed part of the original furnishings of the Çahil Sütun and how it came to be in its present state. The second will be the fragments themselves, whose structural features, when considered within the body of knowledge of carpet weaving in this period, will reveal much about the creative and technical feats required to make a carpet of this ambitious scale and design. Finally, I will situate the reconstructed carpet within its original context of the Çahil Sütun and the Safavid court in the mid-17th to early 18th century. Scholarship around carpets tends to fixate on categorization, chronology, and stylistic analysis. My own approaches veer away from such questions, focusing instead on space, experience, and context. Visitors to Isfahan in the 19th century noted the presence of a dilapidated carpet on the floor of the large audience hall of the Çahil Sütun, of sufficient age to suggest that it was a remnant of the palace's Safavid heyday. James Maurier, an English diplomat who lived in Iran between 1808 and 1809, noted in his travel journal that there was a carpet with a large pattern in the palace, dating to the time of its construction, and that it was in a state of disrepair. By the 1880s, pieces of the carpet began to disappear from the Chehil Satun and reappear as collectible fragments on the market. The Iranian historian Jaberi Ansari recalls the dismantling of the carpet in his History of Isfahan and Rey, specifying that it disappeared from the Chehil Satun piece by piece between 1880 and 1887. The fragments attracted the attention of scholars and collectors in Europe and America, as the Chehil Satun carpet gained fame as the largest carpet ever made. By this point, growing knowledge about carpet weave structures had allowed scholars to identify this carpet as being of Indian rather than Iranian manufacture. F.R. Martin, one of the authors, author of one of the earliest volumes on the history of carpets, wrote of the Chehil Satun carpet in 1903 that it had been, quote, transformed on the backs of two elephants. This apocryphal tale would persist in several later publications on the fragments. Today, the carpet survives in 13 fragments distributed across 11 different collections around the world. These account for about one quarter to one third of the complete carpet. The 19th and early 20th century sources just discussed provide a critical link between the 13 surviving fragments and the palace, telling us with certainty that these pieces once formed a carpet that lined the floor of the Chehil Satun at least as early as 1808, though it had likely been in place for much longer. While the narrative provided by the 19th and early 20th century sources is particularly useful for understanding what happened to the carpet after 1880, it tells us little about the state of the carpet prior to this point and almost nothing about the original circumstances of its creation and use. The best source for probing these questions is the carpet fragments themselves. If the Chehil Satun carpet indeed covered the entire floor of the audience hall, it would have been about 9 by 18 meters. This immediately poses problems from a technical perspective, given that the largest carpets to survive from either India or Iran in the 17th century do not exceed about 4.8 meters in width. In light of this digital reconstruction of the complete Chehil Satun carpet, shown here on the right, which I produced by extrapolating the complete pattern from the fragments, a close technical analysis of the fragment in Frankfurt reveals much about how the carpet was constructed. This fragment is a transverse section of the carpet, which originally ran parallel to its short end borders. On this fragment, the direction of weave is the opposite of what one might expect, given its place in the overall design. The warp threads run from short end to short end of this transverse section. This negates any possibility that the complete carpet was woven in one piece, given that it would have required a loom with a warp beam not only of the already implausible 9 meter length, but of the entire 18 meter length of the carpet's longer dimension. Instead, the Frankfurt fragment's weave structure proves that the carpet was woven and assembled in a modular fashion. The same evidence can be derived from the corner fragment in Cincinnati, which matches the weave direction relative to the overall pattern of the carpet, just like the Frankfurt fragment does. The move toward modularity in carpets, also demonstrated by several other examples woven in Iran around this time, represents an epistemological shift in ways of thinking about what a carpet is. Prior to the period of Shah Abbas I, Iranian carpets followed strict design rules which had evolved naturally from the mechanics of carpet weaving. The rectangular shape of the loom and the strict horizontal and vertical structure of the weave dictated the rectangular shape of the carpet, from which evolved designs with borders enclosing a central field. This visual paradigm became so consistent that it came to define the carpet as both object and medium. This notion is challenged by modular carpets like the one woven for the Chehel Situn. Is it one carpet or many? With this and other modular examples, the visual paradigm of a carpet is separated from the mechanical process from which it derives. This profound shift in thinking about carpets demonstrates that the most important innovations in carpet weaving in the latter half of the Safavid period came about through dialogue with architecture. The Çahelsetun is part of the larger Devletxane complex in Isfahan, set within a lush garden to the northwest of the Alı Avru. Construction of the palace was completed in 1646-47 during the reign of Shah Abbas II. Over the 75 years between its construction and the siege of Isfahan, the Çahelsetun served as an important ceremonial stage designed to visually represent the axis of Safavid imperial power. It was the primary site for imperial feasts throughout this period and provided the setting for the second coronation of Shah Suleiman in 1668. The large audience hall at the back of the building, reached via procession through a talar and large avon, shown here, was the location of many of these events and the space for which our carpet was made. The audience hall is a space of grandiose scale, with vast surfaces above tiled and painted dado levels, covered by narrative figural paintings and painted and gilded illumination. Each face of this complex structure, from the large area of the upper north-south walls to the narrowest borders connecting the vaults to the east-west avons, is treated as a distinct zone with a different pattern and color scheme. The entire surface of the vaults is covered with delicate floral patterns painted in gold on a dark blue background. Today, there is a mismatch between the richly embellished surfaces of the walls and the blank floors. When the carpet was in situ, the overall impression of the space would have been more balanced. The carpet's dark blue and gold borders would have become another framing device in the same hues, and a similar design to the vaults and the illuminated border demarcating the lower third of the walls. The deep red, green, and gold hues of its central field would have created a visual continuity with the painted and stuccoed walls and ceiling above. More importantly, the massive carpet helped give this space a sense of superhuman scale. When accessed via procession through the talar and throne avon, the audience hall's soaring vaults and triple vaulted ceiling are staggeringly grand. This effect is enhanced by the narrowing frame of view in each successive space leading to the throne avon. The talar's lofty proportions and openness to light and air narrow into the pseudo talar, with its lower ceiling height and solid walls on three sides. From there, the frame of vision concentrates on the mirrored throne avon with its yet lower ceiling height and higher floor level. This narrowing of space and frame of vision completely inverts upon entering the audience hall. The scaled-up proportions would have contributed to this staggering optical effect, making the viewer feel diminutive in the face of a familiar design format at an unfamiliar magnitude. And you can see on the left here this pretty rudimentary digital model that I created, showing the carpet in proportion to the architectural space, just to give you a sense of the magnitude of this carpet and its proportionality to the Çahelsetun's audience hall. The nature of this commission remains a subject of speculation. Based on the arguments laid out above, we know that this carpet was produced specifically for the Chehil-Setun's audience hall, with its dimensions, design, and functionality in mind. This interpretation assumes agency on the side of both commissioner and weaver, framing the Chehil-Setun within the wider context of carpet weaving for Iranian palaces, tombs, and shrines in the 16th and 17th centuries. Iranian weavers created bespoke carpets for royal architectural commissions throughout the Safavid period, both before and after the construction of the Chehil-Setun. Why then, when faced with the question of how to carpet the Chehil-Setun's audience hall, would its designers have turned to the Deccan rather than the weaving ateliers of Iran? While the question remains up for debate, two possibilities seem most likely to me. For one, it's possible that the challenge of weaving such a massive carpet, one that would appear to seamlessly cover the entire floor of the Chehil-Setun's audience hall, could be more easily met by outsourcing the project to the Deccan. Indian weavers, particularly in the Deccan region in the 17th century, seem to have specialized in producing these extremely large durbar carpets. Examples woven as single piece rather than modular carpets, like the Chehil-Setun carpet, include a garden carpet, which was photographed in the collection of the Maharaja of Jaipur, shown on the left, which measured over 19 meters in length. And for comparison, the Chehil-Setun carpet was estimated to be 18 meters in length. Although this carpet, having been woven in one piece, was only half the width of the Chehil-Setun carpet. Another example on the right in the slide is this medallion design carpet now in the Museum of Islamic Art in Doha, which measures nearly 16 meters in length, but again is much narrower than the Chehil-Setun carpet due to the constrictions of weaving such a carpet in one piece. Another possible comparison may be found in an equally fragmented and dispersed carpet woven in India with animal grotesques. This carpet was estimated by another scholar called Stephen Cohen to have been of a similar scale to these massive Durbar carpets based on the proportions of its design. You can see on the left two of the fragments on display recently in the Victoria and Albert Museum. And on the right, the reconstruction by Stephen Cohen. So, with these comparisons in mind, perhaps the motivation for commissioning a carpet for the Chehil-Setun in the Deccan was purely practical. What was the best way to produce a carpet big enough to cover this entire large floor area? The production of this carpet also took place at an important moment in Safavid Deccanate relations, leading to a second possible explanation for its commission. The construction of the Chehil-Setun took place amidst an ongoing conflict between the Safavids and the Mughals over control of Kandahar, a region of modern-day Afghanistan, which was an important overland trade corridor for both powers. The Deccanese Sultanates, which maintained independence from the Mughal Empire until the final conquest of 1687, were natural allies of the Safavids on the Indian subcontinent. The Chehil-Setun carpet, in this context, could easily have been a diplomatic gift commissioned in the years following the palace's commission. However, no documentary evidence has been found to corroborate this idea. Whether the motivation for procuring a Deccanese carpet for the Chehil-Setun was practical or political, or some combination of the two, it was not an isolated move. This commission fits into a broader context of exchange of carpets and textiles across the interconnected Indo-Persianate region. broad-reaching artistic exchange between Safavid Iran and the Persian-speaking Deccani courts included carpets going in both directions. A group of carpets in the Asar Mahal and some in the Bijapur Archaeological Museum, shown on the right, were likely imported prior to 1674 and attest to this two-way exchange. So Safavid carpets reaching the Deccan around the same period when the Çahil-Sıtun carpet was commissioned. Deccani weavers also seem to have produced local copies or carpets inspired by the carpets imported from Iran, reflecting a key awareness of weaving methods and designs across the two regions. At the same time, Safavid weavers evoked Indian carpet designs in the second half of the 17th century, with, for example, the increasing use of upright, symmetrical floral compositions. And I've given you two examples to see this kind of comparison. So on the left, we have a silk carpet, part of a larger ensemble woven for the tomb of Shah Abbas II in 1671. And you can see that it has these upright, all facing the same way, symmetrical floral compositions, which are evoking something like the carpet on the right, woven in North India sometime in the mid-17th century with similar kind of floral compositions. The Çahil-Sıtun carpet is a reflection of this wider network of materials, craftspeople, and artistic ideas. From a few scraps of well-worn carpet, we can patch together what was previously a 9 by 18 meter blank space in the history of the Çahil-Sıtun. Envisioned as a complete carpet, these fragments constitute an integral layer of the building's conception and design. The disorientation I experienced on encountering fragments of this carpet attests to the continued effectiveness of its optical conceit, intended to distort the viewer's sense of space and emphasize the grand scale of the Çahil-Sıtun's audience hall in concert with the painted and gilded stucco illumination framing the monumental wall paintings above. The carpet's unique construction also speaks to the transformative effects of such bespoke commissions for architecture on ways of making and thinking about carpets in the Safavid period. It's also reflective of a broader network of exchange, particularly of woven media and the craftspeople, technologies, and ideas who formed this medium between Iran and India during this time. The ambitions of those overseeing the Çahil-Sıtun's construction and design pushed the boundaries of the medium, accelerating the breakdown of long-held ideas about the completeness of a carpet being restricted to the technical limitations of the loom. Thank you for your attention, and I welcome your questions in the Q&A or over email.
Well, thank you so much. And what a wonderful slide there to end on, so we can see the detail and also how worn the carpet is. So I'm just trying to imagine how bright the colours might have looked, and how much more impressive it would have been at the time. So it kind of gives you a sense, doesn't it? And you can see the age of the carpet there. So as Margaret said, she'll be welcoming any questions, and so I'll be conveying those to her. Thank you very much for a really informative and interesting talk, Margaret. That's absolutely wonderful. We've already got a question for you, so I'll share that. Someone's asking if you could elaborate on how the carpet got transported to the West. I guess in these pieces, but do we know any detail about that story of the transport?
So I can go back to this slide just showing all of the different pieces. So they all have slightly different trajectories because, as you can see from this list, they ended up in many, many different institutions. Oops. And not all of them are in the West. I believe there is one which was last documented in Istanbul. But it seems that almost all of these fragments made their way to the European and American market via Istanbul. So the carpet scholar who was the originator of that on the backs of two elephants story, and kind of gave this carpet the nickname of the largest carpet ever made. He actually complains in his book about how he wanted to obtain one of these fragments in Istanbul, but it was too expensive. And so this was apparently this hot ticket item for collectors around the turn of the 20th century, but they seem to have all come out of the market in Istanbul. And as I mentioned in the talk, there's actually an Iranian historian who witnessed the dismantling and the dispersal of this carpet in the late 19th century from the palace. But other than that, we don't know if that was kind of illicit and haphazard or what exactly were the mechanics of it being cut up and sold from the palace.
Yeah, thank you very much. Would the fragments then tend to be displayed on people's walls, or were they, how do you, do we know how they were presenting or storing these fragments?
Yeah, I mean, sadly today, not one of these is on display. I mean, I'm not sure. I haven't come across any images or descriptions of these fragments being displayed. I can go back to, yeah, maybe this image can kind of give you a sense of why. I think, yeah, they're logistically challenging to display. And I think, unfortunately, the fact that all of these fragments are now kind of languishing in storage is reflective of a shift in thinking and priorities around collecting carpets. So, in terms of the time period in which these fragments were being sold and collected, my impression from the way that they're discussed in these texts from the early 20th century is that this was considered a kind of curiosity or a specimen. And so this idea of it being the largest carpet ever made, that was really the appeal of collecting these fragments. Because unfortunately, because of the scale and how chopped up it is, I think their kind of ability to be exhibited and like appreciate this carpet as a work of art is somewhat diminished. And yeah, that idea of just having this like specimen of the largest carpet ever made maybe doesn't resonate quite as much today.
Thank you very much. Okay, we've got some more questions that have come in. Again, another audience member thanking you for sharing this wonderful, truly wonderful research. They're asking, have they understood correctly about the carpets of Asar Mahal? Are they Safavid? And where are their fragments, if you know?
Let's see. These carpets. Yeah,
I'm
so
guessing. I'm
these
guessing. Yeah.
carpets, there is some debate about whether these carpets were actually Safavid carpets or very close reproductions of Safavid carpets. I have not had a chance personally to examine these. But I think either way, they're so incredibly close to Safavid carpets from this time period that they are evidence of whether they themselves are imported from Iran or close copies of carpets that were imported from Iran. They provide evidence that Safavid carpets were coming into the Deccan at this time.
Great, thank you very much. Someone else is asking, how it is that we know that the carpet was made in the Deccan. So what is it about the carpet that tells us that story? Is it about the stylistic analysis? Is there documentation? So what is it? What is it that tells us that we know that it the origin of the carpet?
Yes, great question. So, sorry for running through these slides, but basically, it's both a technical information and stylistic analysis that tells us that this carpet is from the Deccan. So, in terms of the technical analysis, other scholars before me and I myself have examined this carpet's weave structure. And there are certain, I won't bore you with like the extremely technical details of that, but it has to do with the foundation threads in the carpet's weave. So by looking at that, that is one kind of diagnostic tool for differentiating between Iranian and Indian carpets from the 17th century. But it's also really a stylistic difference. So this lattice pattern of the carpet is something that appears in a lot of other carpets, particularly carpets from northern India, much more finely woven carpets. So this is a very distinct Indian carpet design. There's also like other small things like what's called in carpet literature as tone sur tone coloring. So that has to do with using different shades of the same color right next to each other, which is something that we see in Indian but not Safavid carpets. So yeah, there hasn't been yet any document to show, by that type of evidence that the carpet was imported at such and such a date. But stylistically and technically, it's very clear that this is not a Safavid carpet.
Thank you very much. Someone else thanking you for your brilliant presentation and asking, also was commenting, given that the Chehel Sütun was a space for receiving foreign ambassadors and staging diplomatic spectacle, do you think that the Safavid court might have commissioned this huge Deccani carpet so that they to help present themselves as a cosmopolitan empire and to show their leadership of the wider Persianate world? So would it not just be a practical decision that I guess that they were making very large carpets in the Deccan, but also that it might help them to present a certain narrative? What would you think about
Yes,
that?
absolutely, absolutely. Thank you. That's a great comment, and I definitely agree with you. And going with that interpretation, there are also other aspects of the Çahil Sütun's design that evoke Indian sources. So one of the wall paintings, not in this audience hall, but in another one of the rooms in this palace, depicts a tale from Indian literature. So we can see this kind of awareness of a broader Indo-Persianate or cosmopolitan sphere in the design of this palace. And so I think that this carpet fits really well within that. And yeah, I really like the way that you put it as seeing themselves as the center of this great Persianate sphere.
Yeah, and the Mughals though might have felt differently, but
Yeah.
someone's asked if you could say the name of the scholar who witnessed the dismantling of the carpet in the 19th century and reference to the literature where it's mentioned. I suppose they'd like to do some further research
Yeah.
of their own.
Yes, so that is from Jabari Ansari's A History of Isfahan and Rey.
Okay, yes, I remember you mentioning that. And what so that he was he that author was the Jabari Ansari is the person who witnessed themselves, or do they write about
Yes,
the
he
witness?
witnessed it. So that time is the period of this carpet's life that has the most sources documenting it. But he was a local historian who wrote about seeing it disappear from the Chehil Setun. I've translated that line from Persian, but that it disappeared piece by piece between 1880 and 1887. And then very soon after that time period, we start to have sources from Europeans who were collecting carpets or buying carpets for the V&A, for example, who are mentioning these fragments coming up on the market.
Someone else has asked, like, do we know really why they were cutting it up and why at that particular time?
I mean, it's hard to say exactly why, but I can say that this is not an isolated case. So this is also the period of the sale and kind of reconstruction of the Artabil carpets, if anyone is familiar with that very famous carpet in the Victoria and Albert Museum. There are other examples that have come up in my research, really in this period of the 1880s, 1890s. I think due to the economic straits of the time, unfortunately, this is a time in which a lot of carpets and coinciding with a time when carpet collecting was reaching a real height in Europe and America, carpets from the so-called classical period of the 16th and 17th centuries were selling for incredibly high prices. So a lot of these carpets that were in, probably it was in a somewhat dilapidated state, also based on the condition even of these fragments. So that was why it was cut up and sold. Sadly.
Yeah, thank you. And sort of linked on the other side, somebody else is asking, you've sort of touched on it, relating to your discussions about the huge size of this carpet, but someone's asking, has anyone ever had any desire or attempt to reconstruct and put the pieces back together?
I mean, I would love to if anyone can think of any kind of funding body that would like to bring all these together, then I would be very, very happy to help organize that. I think it would be I've tried to do this kind of digital reconstruction, which is the next best thing we have, but as you can see, these fragments really spread to the four winds, so bringing them all back together would be a feat.
It would be wonderful. It would
Yeah.
be awe inspiring, I
Yes.
think. Someone else says, I love the architectural completeness of the audience hall with the walls, ceiling, and then this carpet as a collective whole. I actually agree. I can imagine it would have been very a sort of sensory, I don't know, you'd almost get overloaded, right, with all of these colours and fabrics. So yes, as it must have seemed like one was surrounded in a jewel box.
Yes.
And they're asking you, do you know what the intent was? And was it to engage those present in awe? Was it, I don't, yeah, was there an auditory aspect of wanting to carpet the floor? How would the designs, I guess, have sort of, there's all these different sorts of designs, the sort of the pattern in the carpet and its contrast with the patterns on the walls and ceiling. What do you think the intent might have been?
Yes, so I think it was both of those things. So I think this is in my dissertation project. I looked at other spaces that were similarly covered in carpets that really complete this design of the walls and ceiling and create an all-encompassing experience of rich colors and the sensory experience. But I think in particular, this example, because of this, what I've called an optical conceit of the carpet, the massive scale of the pattern, it was really intended to inspire awe and almost make visitors feel small when they walked in. I certainly did when I stood next to the corner piece in Cincinnati. But the other point that you mentioned is an excellent one too about the auditory effect of the carpet in the space. There's actually a European observer from the late 17th century who specifically mentioned that in this palace, because if you think about like the types of scenes that are depicted in the paintings on the wall of this audience hall, there are musicians, lots of different metal and ceramic serving wares, many, many people. It would have been very loud. And so we have this European traveler's account actually saying that the carpets muffled the sound. And that was why it wasn't incredibly loud, even with all of these servers coming in and out, musicians, that the carpet had the effect of muffling all of that ambient noise.
Right, that's really interesting. Thank you. Okay, on to the next question. It's quite a long comment, but I'm not sure if the. Oh, yeah, there is a question as well. Okay. So thank you for the excellent, clear discussion. I have an observation and a question from this person. There was a Safavid vase carpet, which was around 6 meters wide, notably larger than the 4.5 meters that you cite as the max. Fragments exist in a variety of collections and have appeared in the last 20 years on the market. The question is, whether there is any evidence that the carpet you discuss, this Çahelsutun carpet, was specifically made for the Çahelsutun, or whether it might have been a gift which was then placed in the large palace building that happened to fit it, or could even have been cut to fit since it is modular. Is there ever any evidence, I guess, of it being cut down to fit this space? So do we know that it was made for Çahelsutun, I guess is the question.
Okay. Yes, so to the first part of that, thank you. I can picture in my head which carpet you're talking about, so I'm going to go and check that. But I think the point is in terms of the loom width, obviously we don't have any looms from this period surviving. But in any case, I think logically there's just no way that the loom could have been 9 meters wide, if we were to think about this carpet being woven in one piece in the way that a typical rectangular carpet would have been. And in terms of whether it could have been cut down to fit the space or whether it was commissioned specifically for this space, I think I have a couple of points in response to that. So one is that, in the wider context of my research about carpets and architectural context in the Safavid period, this is only one of numerous examples of carpets, really bespoke carpets woven to precisely fit the floor plan of a particular room within a building. And so to me, it really makes sense that this carpet was woven to the dimensions of this room. And those dimensions are also based on extrapolating from the width of the border, the size of the pattern. It seems like this carpet would have been exactly the size needed to fill this room. But of course, the ability to 100% prove that is limited by the fact that it's so cut up into all of these fragments. So I think, and also just because the fragments, I've tried to look at the edges of the fragments to see if they could kind of be pieced back together in that way, but a lot of them have bound edges. They've just been through so much in the last 300 years, that getting a really confident, 100% accurate reconstruction of the carpet based on these fragments, I think, is probably impossible.
Okay, yeah, that does make sense. Thinking about the cutting up, someone else says, "Bravo! Did you see any aesthetic decisions at work in the cutting down of the carpet? What visual qualities were people trying to preserve? Is there any sort of rhyme or reason?"
I don't know. I mean, what do you think? I guess because looking at this, I don't see any rhyme or reason. It gives the impression of a haphazard. Like, this doesn't really seem like a calculated dismantling. And I think that local historian who says that it was dismantled piece by piece, it disappeared piece by piece over a 7-year period. And then looking at how kind of hacked up it was into these pieces, it doesn't seem like there was a lot of consideration put into how the pieces were cut.
It's quite heartbreaking,
Yeah, it
really.
is.
Yeah. Someone comments that it's comparable to the dismantling of Persian manuscripts in the early 20th century, in Iran, and also in Istanbul.
Yes.
With manuscripts being broken up.
Yes, exactly. And I think there's also, to further that comparison, by making these still large but smaller collectible fragments, it turns the carpet into almost like a painting that you could put on the wall, or a smaller object, collectible object, just like paintings were cut out of manuscripts to create something more like a European single painting, taking it out of its physical context and the context of the book.
I think we've come to the end of the questions from the audience. I did have a couple of my own just to add on at the end. Just thinking, do they still make carpets of this kind of size in the Deccan or anywhere? Is there a market for very, very large carpets?
I think so. Yes,
Oh, yeah.
certainly. Gigantic carpets are being made today, and I'm sure that whatever technical limitations they faced in the 17th century are no longer.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think I mean, I know there's like that carpet in the mosque in Abu Dhabi that now claims to be the largest carpet ever made.
Yeah. I
I
was
don't know off the
thinking
top
that
of my head where that
UAE.
was made, but yeah, there is, I guess you could say there is still a fixation on making really big carpets as big as possible.
And can we, thank you. Yeah, I was thinking maybe the UAE would be the place where you might find such a large carpet nowadays. Also, do we know how long it would have taken to make this carpet at the time? Can we sort of make a guess of how many hours of labor it would have been, like man hours?
I mean, I think we're talking about months more than
Yeah.
hours, if not
Well, yeah.
years. Because I mean, while this isn't the most finely woven carpet, just yeah, if you can imagine the amount of time that it would take to hand weave something this large, knot by knot, I think, yeah, we're certainly talking in terms of
Yeah,
months, if
and
not
I was thinking
years,
like
if not hours.
an army of
Yes,
people over. And when I say
definitely
hours, I was
many
thinking how many
people.
thousands and thousands of hours
Yeah,
rather than,
yeah.
Oh, and someone said oh, they've rewoven the Ardabil carpet.
Yes.
And oh, someone else has said in Qom in the 1980s, there was a 50 by 35 meter carpet. So there we go.
Wow.
Lots of people have knowledge about my question.
Yes, so this one has been dethroned thoroughly as the largest
Exactly, but
carpet ever
it
made.
was a marvelous feat at its day. And
Yes.
finally, oh, someone's added, some contemporary Persian carpets have a signature in the carpet field. Would there have been such a thing at the time? Did people put signatures into the carpet?
Yes, there are a few other examples. Unfortunately, none of the pieces of this carpet have a signature. But there are a handful of examples, of carpets, particularly special commissions, akin to this one in some way, carpets that were commissioned for tombs and shrines, for example, were signed by probably the carpet designer or workshop supervisor rather than the people who were actually tying the knots.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Margaret. That's been fascinating. and really appreciate you coming and speaking to us all, and good luck with, because I think you're turning this, you're writing a book on the basis of your PhD. So much luck with all your, all doing that, and then your future research projects.
Thank you, and thank you so much for all of the great questions and comments.
Yeah, thank you to the audience. Really fantastic questions today. So thank you very much. Okay, and have a good evening, everybody. Thank you. Bye-bye.